Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about mind-controlling spells in D&D. Possibly problematic. Do they take player agency away too much? Should they be in the game? They've always been in the game. So, Paul, we planned this more than a week ago.
Well, we should mention that this topic comes to us from a viewer, Josh James. Yes, excellent.
Thanks to Josh for suggesting it. So Josh suggested this maybe 2 or 3 weeks back, mm-hmm. and we both thought it was an excellent, excellent subject, and already, you know, a thing that we have both, I think, wrestled with in the past. And then this totally came up in my Friday game just like 36 hours ago.
Interesting.
And it was a huge, you know, dilemma, actually. Yeah.
I also immediately, what came to mind for me was at the most recent HelgaCon where you were running and I was playing the adversary NPC and I mind controlled one of the players and it sort of came up then.
And yep,
that was an interesting moment.
And our friend Lauren also reminded me after Friday night that in another game, also at HelgaCon, it also came up. One of the players charmed a villain, and then the player character was eliminated. What to do about that? And
yeah. We could talk about the infamous Gaius spell in the outdoor spoliation.
Among the spells in classic D&D, right? Like at first level you have charm person,
yep.
And then at second level or third you have hold person, and then there's at higher levels there's charm monster and hold monster and suggestion and Gaius and feeble mind and confusion, and a bunch of stuff like that. And you know, now once I started making notes for this, I was like, we could do a whole show just on charm person.
I feel like things like charm person and Gaius, I think, are perhaps the most egregious, right? Like, you're taking player agency away to certain degrees, right? Like, you can certainly talk about, like, hold person or other forms, like, you know, ghoul paralysis. We had that happen to me in that Bill Webb game, and I was starting to get antsy about it. You can do nothing. Sorry, your turn is nothing. Move on. Annoying, right. But also always feels fairly temporary, right?
Right.
You know, sleep spells, etc., stuff that makes you just lose a turn. But then you get into no, I'm going to dictate your behavior, and that gets perhaps even a little more severe and makes players a little more unhappy, I think.
That makes a lot of sense, and it's funny that comes up as a first level spell, right? So in original D&D. You know, before Magic Missile was even invented and added to the game, you know, there were two real go-to offensive spells for wizards, and they were Sleep and Charm Person. So right out of the box, you have to deal with that as a beginning player and a beginning DM of this occasionally arguable, like, exactly what does Charm Person do, never mind all the higher-level spells on the table. So on the one hand, you know, you have this, like, you know, as the subject of one of those spells, it sucks. As a caster of one of those spells, it's pretty great. So particularly when you're a starting classic D&D wizard with exactly one spell, you know, it's pretty nice that the one spell does something pretty powerful.
Yeah. Now, have you done a Through the Ages on Charm Person?
I'm pretty sure I have. I'm pretty sure if you search my blog, I have that there.
Because even that spell, right, throughout the various editions of D&D, varies in sort of how it presents what's happening. Anything from, like, the caster is your friend to, like, you completely dominate the target or various things like that.
Right. So before we dig more into that, I want to point this out. Like, so before you even get to D&D, right, there's the pulp literature tradition. Yep. And, you know, like, before you even start playing a game, what are wizards known for? Well, you know, they're known for mind affecting magic, probably more than they are flashy, you know, explosive fireball stuff in the literature. And if you go to you know, someone like Robert Howard with the Conan stories, the main things that you're being warned about by wizards are their hypnosis effects. Mm-hmm. And in what is it? It's in his story, People of the Black Circle. There's a moment where Conan, with four friends, charges into a wizard's fortress, and they all get hit by a spell where they're paralyzed. Mm-hmm. Seems a lot like Hold Person. And then in addition to that, the wizard can control them one at a time to step up to the dais and allow him to slit their throats, right? So instant death for everybody affected by this spell, with the sole exception of Conan, who manages to break out of it the last minute. So it's certainly
a better save, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So it's certainly a literary tradition that wizards have these powers, and that they're incredibly powerful. And that's probably the primary thing that they're known for before you even start gaming this kind of stuff. So it's not too surprising how it gets into the game.
I mean, I would also point out that, like, it's said that a lot of the inspiration originally for Cleric came from Harryhausen films and vampire films, right, specifically. And then you get into the whole, like, Dracula charm gaze type of thing. Plus, I guess inversely, you could talk about Turn Undead, maybe, is a mind control?
Some people, yeah. Ish. Some people.
Yeah, okay. Yep. Anyway, sorry, go on.
Morale check type thing, some people say. So let's talk about Charm Person.
Yeah, okay, great.
First level spell, and we constantly wrestle with, you know, and both as player and DM, what exactly is the effect of that? Mm-hmm. And so if you do look across different editions, clearly the designers, that spell has changed a lot over the editions.
Yep.
And it seems pretty clear that the incredible potency when it first appeared was perhaps a little bit overpowered, and it's been dialed down. Like, even within 8 months of the first D&D supplement, they were already modifying it to kind of tone it down a bit. So maybe you could bring that image up that... So in the earliest publication, what I have there is 0th edition, The Little Brown Books. The phrasing, that's a direct quote from the text of the spell. It says, the victim comes completely under the influence of the caster, and it lasts until it's dispelled, so it's effectively permanent.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty powerful for a first level spell.
Yep, for sure.
Right. And then in the next year, when the first supplement came out, they added this table that says, well, it's not totally permanent. You do get a regular save. If you're super smart, it's every day. If you're stupid, it's once a month. And if you have average intelligence, it's like once a week or every 2 weeks or something like that, depending on your intelligence. That sort of was maintained through first and second editions.
There, Dan.
Oh,
sorry.
No sweat.
Lost the image. My fault.
That's okay. I more or less can remember that. So even if that's gone, I know what I'm going to say anyway.
Go for it. Go on.
And then in first edition, the effect of it turned into the changed from completely under the influence to trusted friend and ally.
Mm-hmm.
That stuck around through at least third edition. Then the duration became only 1 hour per level instead of in perpetuity with weekly saves. I don't think that spell even existed in 4th edition. So I searched the whole 4th edition player's handbook, and I couldn't find it anywhere.
Interesting.
It is in 5th edition, and now it just lasts 1 hour, the end, and still has this and now it's not even trusted friend. It's friendly acquaintance, which seems even lower powered than anything else. Are you finding Charm Person?
I'm looking up on D&D Beyond, because one of the things that 5th edition does a lot is it likes to play with status effects. So one of the things that it does do is it puts the charmed status on you, which says that you cannot attack the person who has charmed you, and the charmer has advantage on any ability checks to interact socially with you. But that's still pretty, it's not, when your turn comes around, I'm moving your guy around the board and dictating what you do.
Boy, by my standards, that seems really weak sauce. That is not much of an effect.
Yeah.
So anyway, but nonetheless, any one of those additions, you know, you do have to make some kind of judgment call about what would a trusted friend do.
I feel like the 5th edition version, and this is an interesting aspect of this that's probably plagued the game throughout, is the sort of, like, what is the use case scenario for this spell? Are we talking about, in combat, I am going to control you, so now you become a resource for me for the combat? Or are we talking about, like, social situations where, you know, I'm trying to get, a better deal at my room at the inn, or I'm trying to, you know, convince the ruler to let me do something that he normally wouldn't do, or et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, my idiom, I mean, you know, coming out of original D&D text where it's mostly all dungeon adventures, I mean, my instinct is like, well, this has to be useful in a you know, aggressive dungeon situation.
Yep.
I'm assuming it's getting an additional combatant on your side.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've always liked to... one of the things that has bothered me about Charm Person and a lot of spells that get used in social situations is it inevitably asks the question, how... we don't need to keep staring at this, right? It inevitably asks the question, how obvious is spellcasting? And the more I've thought about this problem, the more I like to say, very. Like, magic should be flashy and in your face. Like, I'm waving my hands, I'm incanting arcane words of power. To which end, I've started ruling Charm Person more and more like, you're clearly ensorcelled. Like, this, like anyone looking at this person would be like, there's something wrong with this person. They're doing weird stuff.
I think I was on the fence about that until I heard you explicate that, and then I immediately was like, yes, that's the way I've got to judge, too. So now I'm totally in the same boat with that.
Yeah, yeah. So I like that, and I like that sort of... And that leads you more in the direction of, like, you have complete control, because they're kind of like, yes, master, right? It kind of that hypnosis. It gets back to that Howard-inspired kind of feel, I think.
I totally agree with that. And also a lot of comic books, actually. Like, if I read Marvel comics with either Thor or Doctor Strange, that's also kind of the effect of someone's, like, slow, kind of half-zombified, their speaking has been changed.
Yeah.
So I kind of like that, too. And, you know, it's interesting because if you say, you know, it's one of those things in the evolution of D&D whereby if you say, well, to begin with, it's overpowered, you know, the totally under control, okay, we're going to modify this to trusted friend. But now that makes way more rulings difficulties.
Yeah.
Like, I know what totally under the control means. You're totally under the control. Done. But as soon as you go, well, they're only a trusted friend, I'm not entirely sure what that means. And now we start to have, actually, one of the other players Friday night actually started to bring up Wittgenstein's philosophy as part of this. Like, well, what do words mean in a social construct? And what does control mean after all, right? And now we're actually debating Wittgenstein after the game as a result of Charm Person.
Yeah.
And it's a much bigger can of worms to adjudicate. Versus the very, very powerful, very simple structure that started with.
Yeah, I feel like if you're trying to balance these kinds of effects, I think that I would look more at duration and ability to break out than the actual strength of the effect. Because, whittling down the strength of the effect builds all these gray areas that are really difficult.
So, like, one question I had after the game, so you think about these other spells. I mean, I think you basically said this in the preface. If, like, compared to hold person, right? Charm person versus hold person. Are they equivalently problematic, or is one, you know, are we more comfortable with one than the other?
I think we are more comfortable with a paralytic effect because it's just very easy to adjudicate. Oh, it's your turn. Yeah. No, you're still paralyzed. Sorry, move on.
Right.
And I feel like 5th edition has tried to address this by making most spells repeatably savable. So at least you get a die roll. Like, you never do nothing. You at least are making a check.
I think that first came up in 4th.
Really?
I believe that started coming up in 4th. And I will say, so like, it's funny how much, you know, ghoul paralysis is obviously very similar to this. So this came up, I think, 2 weeks ago when I was playing in a 5th edition game, and we were attacked by ghouls. And I was like, oh, ghouls! Jeez, they are freaking dangerous, and we really got to pay attention to this. And someone got paralyzed and was like, everybody defend him. Everybody defend that guy. And it came around, and then that person got a save on the next round. And I was like, we what? You get a what? Who? What? And I was like, yeah, you get a save every round to just break out of it. And I was like, oh, well, that's well, this isn't really as dangerous as I'm accustomed to. This isn't really that bad. Yeah. So that, I mean, for me, that made it much less terrifying than I'm accustomed to. That seems too easy.
I wonder for, like, being under a charm effect, if you get a similar feel for that, right? Like, if I'm under a charm effect, am I more willing to ham it up as a charm victim if every round I'm... Well, let me first roll. Oh, no, I didn't break out of it, so... Yes, master. Right. Or, I don't know, I've had players who both delight in playing into the charm. Great, a chance to beat up on my friends. Who could ask for more? And I've had players who rebel against it and try to, like, well, I'm not playing the game well unless I try to, like, you know, genie interpret the commands and say, how can I skew your command to something that's actually advantageous to something I would want to do?
Right. And so I think that both of us could, like, draft a list of what players we know would fall in which category there. And, you know, in my Friday, so in my game on Friday, right, the party busts into, you know, actually a goal boss that they have been pursuing for like a year. Mm-hmm. Big mob of giant type guards. And the big boss charms one of the party's lead fighters and just says, kill that guy. And I trust my players a lot, right? So the players that I have at the table are wonderful at this. And it came up afterwards that, like, what was happening was really highly dependent on how much I totally trusted the players to make a decision in this really, we all agree, really kind of hazy gray zone. And in other cases, I've had to put the law down more about, you know, you've got to do this, and then actually, like, you know, threaten XP penalties or stuff like that. And that all gets very strange. Yeah. So on top of other things, it becomes really important about how well, you know, what the particular players want to play with that. It makes the action a lot different.
Yeah. And I think that's going to vary from player to player, right? Some players just don't want to do that stuff. I mean, personally, I would delight in being charmed because there's so many clever ways you can roleplay that, right? You could certainly play the glassy-eyed yes master, but immediately my head starts going to, like, what if I'm totally aware and horrified by what I'm doing? Oh my god, I'm so sorry! Please forgive me! As I wail on someone.
Well, okay, so I, one of my notes here is, have you, Paul, ever been charmed in a game?
Not as a player.
Right.
Certainly as a DM. Certainly, okay, right. as a controlling an NPC, good certainly point. Yes, but never
right. as a player, I have never actually been on the receiving end of a charm person. So, to be perfectly frank, I don't know what that's like.
It's probably because we don't often play fighters, right? Who are always the target because they have the worst saves.
Yeah, good point. So there's your point about the ways you could play it. So there is a. There's a Walt Simonson comic where of Elric, actually, right? Mm-hmm. So around 2000, Moorcock actually scripted this comic, and Walt Simonson did the art for it. And Elric charms a giant, and the giant does actually what you just said, is like, you have ensorcelled me with a powerful spell, Elric, and I am forced to do your bidding, but I will hate you forever, and actually, you know, and the giant actually dies as a result of it, actually. He's like, you are merciless as you destroy me in this bed of lava.
I have a pre-generated character that is in my sort of regular stable of pre-gens that I use for D&D games, who has a lot of magic items that come with a servant. So they, like, he's got an Afridi bottle, and he's got an intelligence sword, and I play and generally the character has a kind of, you know, Arabian Nights kind of thematic elements. So I really play up how upset all these servants are about being
great,
you know, under servitude, right? The Afrit always does exactly what you ask and complains bitterly about it the whole time.
I think that's great.
It's totally free.
I think that's a great way to play it, and that's really nice to have in your repertoire of ways to come at it.
So I haven't been charmed, but I have been gayest. That's an interesting story, and I feel like we should talk about that. So let me give a little background. So every year at this one convention, Dan runs a game called Outdoor Spoliation. If you go search for it on his blog, you'll see lots of entries. The game is based on exploring the wilderness using the outdoor survival rules as is dictated in the original D&D books. And you always bring the same characters, and
Correct. A lot
of people have played it year after year, and so we start choosing the same characters, and so we've assumed some level of continuity between the games. My character at the very end of one game ended up getting Gaius cast on him, and I think he had to fork over a whole bunch of treasure. Is that right? Like,
So the standard original D&D rule is a wizard in a castle, their default thing is either you give them magic items or they Gaius you to go get treasure.
Right. Okay, so he was commanded to go get treasure.
Right.
Right. The next year, Dan ran this adventure again, and the traditional character I choose was not in the pile of characters. And the whole plot ended up revolving around, go and find this guy. Not really whole plot, because again, Dan doesn't, this is a very sandbox kind of setting, right? Like, you
I think
really
there was a, there was a middle session where you went to get the treasure, and then right at the end of that session, Paul, said, my character takes it in the middle night and just disappears.
Right. Oh, yes, yeah. That's right. Yep, so I took the treasure. I think maybe that happened all in one adventure.
Yeah,
maybe,
you might,
like,
I think
got
right.
the Gaius right. cast on him in the middle of the adventure, went off, the party wanted to get treasure anyway, so that's what we went and did. And then we ended it with, like, and I disappear in the middle of the night.
That's
now,
it.
You know, had it been a rig, I think I had some crazy plan that I was, like, going to deliver the loot, and then once the spell was off, find a way to murder the caster. But yeah, so we started the next session, and the character's not even there, and I was like, what the, damn it, right? And so then, of course, I pushed really hard for the party to, like, we have to go find this guy. And I think I even took some other character that no one had played before and interpreted him as the son of.
Like, yeah.
My father's been ensorcelled, we must save him.
Yeah,
let's go.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought that was delightful. Yes, okay, yeah. So now that I think about it, right, so I think I had to play, like, a good half of that session as a character who was under Gaius, right? So
right.
I had to roleplay that. And I think,
right.
if I recall, the way that I roleplayed it was that I was totally conscious of what had happened, that I knew I was being compelled by a spell, I was incredibly unhappy about it, but I must do it.
Right, right. And, you know, and again, as a top-notch player, that worked immensely well. And, you know, and then you were in conflict with the other characters, and they would tie you up overnight,
yep.
I think, until
yep.
you found a way to escape and stuff like that. And, you know, I've seen that kind of stuff get testy at the table
yeah.
in the past. That worked great. I thought that worked wonderfully.
I think because all the players knew what had happened, right? I wasn't being coy about it. I was
right.
like, look, I had the spell cast on me. I'm sorry. I like you guys. I don't want
right.
to do this stuff. But
right.
I still did it to my best ability, right? Like, I wasn't
yeah.
like, oh, I'll yeah. just go take all this treasure off to my master now. I was like, no, I'm going to steal it in the middle of the night and sneak off because that's the best way to get it done.
Right. And, you know, one of the things about Gaius, right,
mm-hmm.
that comes out of Irish Celtic mythology, of course, is, you know, it's a top-level spell, right? So Charm Person is the first-level spell, and Gaius is a top-level, sixth-level in original D&D. That's as high as the spell levels go. And so at least my idiom is that the higher-level spells should have more room for DM adjudication and judgment. You know, as far as, like, possibly mystical, surprising things happening in the cosmos that aren't totally under your control.
Right.
So with Gaius, like, I do a lot, and we've had one of our characters in my regular campaign, Gaius, for about a year, is that I do a lot of, like, massaging around the edges of it. You're supposed to do this, but what's the time frame on it?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
depending on what I feel for a good session, I'm like, well, you could, if you really feel this side quest is going to help you, you feel pretty confident that you could do that for like 1 week. You know, as long as you're going in the general direction of this mission, that seems acceptable. And the other thing I actually did, kind of looking back to Irish mythology around Cuchulainn and things like that, is as long as the current player is pursuing this Gaius, they actually have an advantage, is they actually have an ability score boost at the moment.
Hmm.
Coming out of Irish mythology of, yeah, the Gaius is something that you're compelled to follow, but it actually makes you more powerful.
Interesting.
So there's this yin-yang to it. So at the moment, some of my players actually would like more Gaiuses because of that, right? Now they're actually like, where can we get more Gaiuses, right?
That's strange.
Unusual, but that's what's happened.
What do you rule as the downside? What happens to them when they start to go astray.
Yeah, if they go astray, then their ability, right? I think the ruling is that their ability scores go down, mm-hmm. right? That's the fundamental thing Gaius usually does is you lose if you deny the mission, your strength score goes down by a point a day or a week or something like that. So I thought it was kind of an interesting yin yang to go. As long as you're pursuing it, it actually goes up. I think that's.
And
the
do you
standard.
Just implement that purely mechanically, or I seem to recall, and I don't know where this comes from, and I'd have to go read the text of the spell again to remind yeah. myself. But I seem to recall having ruled on players where I put a lot of flavor into it, and I say like, you just don't feel well. Yeah. You feel really ill. You're feeling really tired, really lethargic. Oh, and you're starting to throw up every morning. Like I add a lot of that flavor, and it just they. The funny thing is, even though it has no mechanical effect at all,
right.
it makes them miserable, and they really want to turn the party around and go deal with it right away.
Okay, that's interesting. I tend to be minimalist and literalist, so yeah. I my tendency is just like take away a strength point, or take away a constitution point. What is it? It says so. The original rule says any attempt to deviate from the performance of the task will result in weakness, and ignoring the Gaius entirely brings death.
Yep. Yeah. So I try to step them towards that to make it clear yeah. that like you're on the path towards weakness and death.
Right.
Like.
Right. I think later editions make that more mechanically concrete of like, and so I think that I start charging constitution points if they're way off track. So again, like I feel like that's legitimate with a sixth level spell of, you know, giving the DM a lot of operating room for that. But like a first level spell that's on the table all the time, every first level wizard has it, every first level party encounters it, and I feel like that has to get dialed in, you know, very, very rigorously because it's going to get used so much and the players are going to have, you know, be able to use it so much. It really should be a known quantity about how it works.
Yep. Yep, I agree.
Which makes it very problematic because it's simply not.
Right, right. Yeah, and I guess the thing is, even if you as DM have thought it through and are like, okay, well, this is how Charm Person is going to work for me and I understand it, more likely I would think it's probably going to come up where the players are using it. Oh, like, you know, charm the orc, I charm the guard, I charm whoever, and they're going to be perfectly happy with however you rule it because whatever, it's great for them. And then when the tables get turned, which inevitably happens, and they get a charm spell cast on them, suddenly it's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I will say again, like, so, the yin-yang on this is that, it, you know, classic D&D, the wizard doesn't get very many spells, possibly just one.
Right.
And so if the DM really gimps the effective charm person, the wizard player will be unhappy that their one single interesting shot per day got kind of yanked away from them.
Yep.
I think that's happened to me. I think I've had a low-level wizard hit somebody with charm person, and then really had this very vague, well, they kind of sort of take what you're saying into extra account, but don't do what you said. And I was, you know, disappointed by that.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, and if you compare it to other first level spells, like a sleep spell, I'm giving up a sleep spell, which is going to take out several opponents and completely eliminate them from the fight.
Right.
Charm person should be at least as good as that, right?
I totally agree.
Yeah.
I totally agree. You know, and then, of course, you have the, you know, intelligence gathering component. And if you have somebody, you know, wandering around after you for the rest of the day telling you what's up ahead, that's pretty damn potent. I would say, like, that's about equitable with sleep, at least. But if you dial it down, then, yeah, it seems out of joint with sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do like it, ultimately. I do like it when it's used in social situations. I don't want to take that away from the spell. I mean, more often than not, especially, like, even in just straight dungeon adventures, right, you'll see it of, like, okay, I charm one of the goblins, we eliminate all the goblins, don't kill the charmed one, we are going to question him.
Right.
Right, that's seems pretty classic.
Totally, totally. Now, one aspect which occurred to me, again, with this incredible down-dialing of the effective charm person over the ages, is I wonder if that's in any way related to the presumed large party size when D&D started. So with original D&D, again, the main effect of charisma is that you can have a fairly large body of hirelings of 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or possibly 12 hirelings per PC. So like when this was originally invented, and each player was maybe running half a dozen characters, maybe, I don't know, and charm person takes away one, that doesn't seem quite so punishing. But when you dial it down and it, like every player just has one single character at the table and you take away that whole character that you're playing, maybe all of a sudden that becomes more punishing than it was when the rule was originally written. Or same for a whole person or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I thought you were going in more of like the just number of people at the table. Because certainly, gotcha. Like, you look at old school, you know, a lot of the old modules are all written 6 to 10 players, right? Whereas the 5th edition expectation seems to be basis about 4.
Yeah.
But actually controlling multiple characters, I don't know. Do you think that was really prevalent for a long time?
Well, not a long time. I will stipulate that. But I mean, you know, Dave McGarry says that when the very first game with Dave Arneson, he's like, I had a thief with 20 men under him. So that was at least how it really initially started. Is you definitely had a whole body of troops.
Interesting.
Regularly. It didn't last very long. I don't think that kind of thing lasted super long. But it's there in the charisma rule all the way through 0th, 1st, 2nd edition.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, I don't know. So, I also think that, like, again, I think far more often, especially when we talk about charm person, that it typically is used in the other direction, right? It's a spell for players.
Yeah.
It seems reasonably uncommon that it gets used in the other direction until you get to higher levels where you have monsters that have vampires with their gaze attack and such.
I'll say this, right? So some of the early editions have these like solo play rules, right? So you roll dice and the dungeon gets randomly made and the monsters are all randomized. And I've tried to use it. And I will say the single most punished, and you can talk, well, you've got spiders with instant death poison and you have, you know, possibly a whole bunch of goblins. But the single most perilous thing about that system, if I have one PC, is running into an evil wizard with either charm person or sleep.
Yeah.
Because that's a single, you know, because you can run into 1d6 wizards, right? And potentially they all have charm person and one single saving throw and I'm just, bam, my game is over. They've taken me over and I'm done. So if you, at least initially, I found that actually is the single most dangerous thing, specifically in the context of solo play. If you have a party and one person gets taken over, maybe they can still win. But as a solo, as one person, you're finished instantly.
I seem to recall the first time you ran Rappanathic for us, we had a famous encounter where I had a magic user who snuck into the room invisibly and cast Charm Person on the like 9th level cleric, who was the commander of all the troops in the room.
Yeah.
And he, like, rolled a 1 or something, right? Like, just...
I have that on my blog. You know, I was looking at that the other day. I have it on my blog, and I have a photo of the 1, right? So it's documented in perpetuity. Is that I think I could only miss the save. He had some bonuses and magic items. I could only miss the save on a 1, and it came up.
And it came up
freaking
1.
And
that completely... And I don't know, maybe you were being overly generous because we were running out of time, but... that completely neutralized the whole fight, right? That we were like, we were in way over our heads anyway. And you were just like, yep, you tell them to get the treasure and they do it, right? Because
there's more and more, like the tapestries and the chandeliers and the gold candlesticks and 2 chests of treasure and a magic fountain that even disconnected is still spurting water everywhere as you carry it through the dungeon and on and on and on and on. It seems clear to me, right? It seems the completely under control seems very clear to me, and it seemed easy to make that call, and it was super friggin' funny.
it was pretty hilarious, and I would say, like, by making the spell more obvious, I think you make it more enjoyable for everyone, right? Like, we don't have to deal with situations where the party has to role play. Well, I don't know that he was charmed, so I think he's just a jerk. And now we have all this inter-party strife, right? Whereas instead, I mean, a game like D&D especially, now I might not say this for other systems, we're talking about Cthulhu or something.
Right.
Don't quote me on this, but for D&D, we're essentially meant to be a cooperative adventuring band who's, you know, out to help each other. I think it really helps to be like, well, clearly he's not himself. Like, you can tell at a glance that your friend is attacking you and is not... It's not your friend, right?
I like that.
An unwilling participant,
right? And when it goes into the vague, you know, when it goes into the vague ruling bit of trusted friend or acquaintance. It's like, okay, trusted friend, but now how does that relate to your colleagues that you've been partying and you know, trusting your life with up until now? Is that totally overridden, or are they in the same level? Are you, if they have, can you have a debate between the two groups, which isn't super fun?
Right. It's certainly a much bigger role-playing challenge of like, now I have to be like, oh my God, my best friends are fighting. I have to do something about this.
Right. And if that's the rule, it seems like that would be the rule every single time. Like every single time you have these two competing parties, and then it, like the charm person just basically turns into, you know, reality show argument, basically.
It certainly makes, like at best, at that case, at best, you've just neutralized the person because they're being unhelpful as they run around and beg everyone to stop fighting.
Yeah, I mean, and I could imagine an argument about that. I mean, you know, pulling one person from one side to the other is a big shift. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of like, you know, what if one vote in Congress changes, that's actually a two-vote swing.
Yeah.
So I could imagine at someone actually saying, well, for balance purposes, that's all charm person does. It just takes you out of the fight and you're just indecisive. That's not the way I rule it, and that's not what it says in the rules, but I could imagine an argument for that being balanced.
Well, and I mean, we might be overly harsh here on 5th edition's version of charm person simply because the scale of spells is different, right? Okay. I'm sure there must be a higher level charming spell in 5th edition. Right. Earlier editions probably don't have as much variation in power levels, right? I'm saying this off the cuff, but I'm going to go do a quick search here and see if I can find how many charm spells exist.
I mean, to me, 5th edition looks very much like 3rd edition, which looked very much like 1st edition. So, I see charm person and charm monster, which is exactly the same as been in the game since 0th. I mean, the effects.
Yeah, even Charm Monster has the same verbiage in it of being friendly and having the charmed effect. Now, and to which the most impactful of the charmed effect seems to me of they can't attack, charm creature can't attack the charmer or target the charm with harmful abilities or magical effects.
In 3.5, they started introducing a spell called Dominate Person or Monster.
Exactly.
Which was the more potent, right? So they have that, yeah.
Yep, there's a 5th level spell, Dominate Person. Yep, there you go. Okay. Yep.
So I think 1st edition, right? So you go to 0th edition and you have the Charm Person spell at 1st level and then a number of monsters, and you mentioned vampires and dryads and something else have a charm person effect. And then in 1st edition, you know, even in 1st edition, Gygax attempted to split them out. And there's some text in 1st edition that says, well, you know, charm person from a monster is not the same thing as charm person the spell. Charm person from a monster totally dominates a person. But charm person the spell just makes you a friend. And so that, so here you see with the 3rd or 5th edition dominate spells, the formalization of that split. Mm-hmm. Which, I don't know. I see why they did it. It seems complicated, but I see why they did that.
Yep. I mean, the scale of levels is just different, right? Like in 5th edition, we're looking at up to level 20, not up to level 10.
True. I mean, that's the same as like 3.5.
Yep.
That's the same as the 3rd edition idiom.
Yep.
True-ish, yeah.
Can't remember how higher level that makes. Does that mean we have up to 9th level spells maybe? So a 5th level spell, rather than being near the top of all powerful things, is actually in the middle?
Correct-ish. Basically correct. I have a whole essay I can do on that issue. Because it's weird. It's weird that the, you know, and that's been the case since even the supplement, right? Even the 1975 supplement to original D&D did that. Is it expanded from 6th level spells up to 9th. That's been the case since 1975. But it's weird that you have all the, what seemed to me ought to be the top end cosmic space and time bending spells of death and no magic and resurrection. They're all at 6th level.
Yeah.
And then you have these weird, fiddly things that show up at 7th, 8th, 9th, like limited wish or delayed fireball. Right at the 7th and 8th, 9th, and so that's always freaked out my brain about why what seems like the ultimate, I you know, conceptual spells are sitting at 6, and then this weird stuff at 7th, 8th, 9th.
Yep, it's fair.
has been my okay. Let me just tell you the situation on Friday night.
Okay, great.
Okay. And I'm gonna ask how you would rule on this.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so I have one player character who's one of the two lead fighters who has been gayest for a whole year to pursue a particular monster and a particular treasure that monster has. So finally, after going through 1, 2, 3, 4 levels of a particular mega dungeon trying to pursue this individual, Friday night, they finally actually encountered him. What have you got there?
This is my DM screen. Get my DM screen.
Oh, okay.
Gonna make a ruling. Okay, I'm ready.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so gayest, right? So, mm-hmm. So gayest to fight this particular creature. Well, this particular creature casts a charm person on that fighter, who just happens to be gayest, nice. Right? And nice. Says, defend me, right? Mm-hmm. Defend mm-hmm. me, which is exactly the opposite of what the gayest says to do, right? Which is to attack him. So the fighter turns around to attack his fellow characters. In addition to that, this lawful fighter also has an intelligent lawful sword. Right, and is currently being controlled to do a chaotic act by a chaotic monster against his own friends, and he's also gayest to do the opposite of what the charm says. What happens?
Awesome. that is fantastic. I love it.
Yeah.
Did you have to?
I did not love it Friday night because I was like, I don't know.
Okay. So hang on, put this down because. It's annoying to hold that up this whole time. Okay, so here's my instinct. I'm going to flip open the confusion spell and apply that to the player.
Oh, all right.
Because they're clearly under powerful magics in either direction that's just breaking their brain.
Okay. You know, and I didn't even think about half of this. Like, I myself wasn't aware about two of the factors there when I started to say what happens. And then the player says, well, what about the fact that I'm gayest? What about the fact that I have a lawful sword? And I'm like, oh my God, what are you doing to me here? Right? Yeah. So, okay.
What did you do? Did you start making control rolls for the sword?
I was desperate.
Yeah. So I think I would be tempted to not consider the sword. Yeah. Because at least if you're using the same rules that I've used in the past, that is applied strictly based on amount of damage, right?
And the fighter is also at the cusp of death because I blasted him with a cone of cold immediately before happened. So he's at about 1/4 normal hit points.
So I think I would have him make the control roll. If the sword's able to take control, then the sword is not charmed. Only the person is charmed. So I'd let the sword do what the sword wants to do. if the sword doesn't take control, then I think the guy, because he's the character, because he's under the effects of both charm and Gaius. Right. Which are totally conflicting, I think. I would flip to the confusion table.
Right. That's great. I don't think I have... Okay, so I didn't have all these factors at the beginning.
So the
very first thing is I said, kill that guy, and he just turns the next player, and I say, you attack that guy. And the player picks up a d20, right, and rolls it. And then he says, well, what about the fact that I have a lawful magic sword? And I was like, eh. And to be perfectly frank, right at that second, I actually didn't want to look up the rules. So I had there was so much chaos going on, I didn't actually want to look that up. So I was just like, roll a die, roll a d6, and if it comes up over 2, the sword will refuse this command.
Right.
And it came up high for him, and so the sword just dropped out of his hand, and he got to do nothing that round.
Okay.
Right. So the sword just refused to be involved and just clanged on the floor out of his hand. No attack happens that round. He does not slay his friend. And so then after that, he was pulling out additional, much less useful weapons. And then he pointed out the gayest, like 2 rounds later. And I was like, lose constitution.
That's great.
Right? Actually, and I was like, okay, you Good lose call. Your constitution bonus.
Yep.
Now your hit points go down. He was like, okay, all right. And then after that, the charmer goes down.
Yeah.
Right. And then the charmer gets hit by a barrage of magic missiles, and the charmer is now unconscious and not given commands. Now, Paul, what happens now?
Sorry, wait, but he's down, right? So he's doing nothing?
The charmer is down, not the charmee.
Oh, I see.
Right.
I
the spellcasting boss is at 0 hit points.
Yeah.
What does the charmed fighter do then?
Oh gosh, I don't know if you have a precedent for whether or not spell effects go away when a caster drops.
Let's say no.
Okay, so I think I would have to make a quick off the cuff decision on that.
Yeah. yes, you do. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yep. So. I think that my instinct is that it's more amusing that the spell effect remains in play and that they're going to go stand over the caster and defend them to try and not let them die. I think that's where I'm
going.
That's
what happened. That was also my ruling.
Yeah, great. Yeah. Let me go back. I have a couple couple pieces of tangible feedback and advice.
Yeah.
First of all, intelligent swords. I have, so again, I have, whenever I run D&D games at conventions, I have this, like, I don't know, 16 or so pre-generated characters. I have them at various level increments, so I just am using them all the time. Every time I run a one-off, here's the characters. I know them well. It's easy.
I see.
Two of them have intelligent swords. And what I've come to discover over time is that players love that and always choose those two characters. So I've had to deal with intelligent swords quite a lot.
Gotcha.
My advice, after having done this many times, is make the moment a player gets an intelligent sword, make them write the mechanics for it on their character sheet. That is now their responsibility to know how to do that check. And you can say, make a will check. Make a control check with your sword, and they should know all the numbers.
Okay.
I say that, like, it's, you know, maybe the numbers could be secret and they shouldn't know the will values of their sword or something. Right. But that just means that it doesn't get used because you've forgotten it or you don't know where it is. It's going to slow down the game, so you end up cutting it, right? I think it's too much to ask to remember to go digging it up in the heat of a moment, which is really when the sword should take control, in the heat of a moment, right?
That's a great observation. I do have a magic sword on an intelligent sword, like on a special index card.
Yeah.
And I kept that for several sessions while the player was trying to figure out what the powers were. And then once they finally discovered it, then I handed over that particular index card for the sword. Rock solid. Your idea is rock solid, and I would recommend that to people.
What I've ended up doing for the convention games is I just go over that raw mechanic. I'm like, you have the intelligent sword. Here's the plus. Here are the target numbers. Write this down. Okay, it's on your character sheet. When I ask you to make this check, you can do the lookup and make the check and know the numbers.
I haven't been doing that, and I've kept it on my side. And yes, I forget, and then the chaotic thing happens, and you're right. I totally forget.
So that's my advice with that one. Now another question comes to me. So this I feel like I have seen. Your party is fighting an evil wizard. He casts Charm Person on your fighter, right? And our fighter's turned against us. The magic user on your party then also casts Charm Person on that fighter. Now what?
That's everything, right? That is why I want to play this game, because that's a mess.
Yep.
It's a freaking mess. Okay, you want my ruling?
Yeah.
Opposed caster level checks each round for who has the more powerful charm.
Okay, I love that you do it each round. I was like, caster level check, that's fine. As long as dice are rolled every round, and that's why I jump.
Oh, yeah.
My instinct is to jump to the confusion table because it's just so easy. It's just a straight 2d6 roll and whatever. But yes, check every round because it's hilarious to have that character. Like, now I'm your friend. That's just... That's delightful.
Right. That's where I'm. That's really interesting because this, we started this discussion and I'm like, I really don't, I was like, I'm unused to / offended by a hold spell getting a save every round. But now here I am wildly entertained at the idea of opposed charm caster effects and how great that would be. I don't know. I don't know I don't know what the hold stuff now. Now with the other stuff, I'm like, I really wouldn't want the spell to totally go away based on one save, right? Like, I feel like these spells have got to be more potent than possibly two rounds of effect.
So you want hold person where I'm rolling every round for a certain period of time? It could come back.
I would be more comfortable with... Yes. I mean, I would be way more comfortable about that.
I mean, that sounds a lot to me like the way Blink works, which is a Again, have I told that story on this stream about the blink spell?
I think I've heard that, yes. Yeah. I think I've heard that, and then someone was invisible and they couldn't find him.
Yeah, so my character was unconscious under the effects of a blink spell, which is not concentration, so I was still making checks every round, my unconscious body disappearing and reappearing, which is hilarious and a highly memorable moment of the game. And what are we doing this for if we're not after making those moments that we clearly remember and continue to recount?
Right. And it's interesting, so it's interesting. I mean, these other spells, confusion has a specific die roll per round, fear, you run away, right? That's, you've got to run away. That's very concrete. Hold, you're paralyzed. The real super trouble one is charm person at first level. Hmm. That is that's the real hard nut to crack. Maybe that should have been higher level. Maybe as DM, you got to sit down and you got to decide in advance these situations of what if you're double charmed? What if, what happens in combat? What happens if the charmer goes down, to make that more concrete? Because as it is in the original books, it's real hazy.
I wonder if you shouldn't, you could potentially apply a hit die cap to it, similar to, say, sleep. Charm person only affects creatures of this hit die or less, so that players eventually cap out of it.
That probably should have been the case. And in fact, it's weird because, in original D&D, I think that actually is the second ever spell.
What, sleep?
No, charm person. No, they're both at the end of the first level list. So for whatever it's worth, charm person is the first attack spell.
Yep.
Right? And then sleep comes right after it. So it's almost like every other attack spell has got some kind of hit die component or some kind, sleep has a maximum effect hit dice. And so it's almost like when charm person was written, they hadn't thought about that whole issue yet.
Yeah.
And maybe it should have had a hit die limit. Moldvay and BX actually adds that.
Oh, adds a hit die cap to charm person?
And in fact, right, yes. Hmm. And he makes it perfectly symmetrical with sleep. So actually the limit of sleep at 4 hit dice is exactly what he does with charm person, so that an ogre can be affected. Different than other editions.
Now, interestingly, have you looked at sleep in 5th edition?
I don't think I have.
So, because this surprised me, because we're now used to things are weaker because save every round, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Sleep, you roll a number of hit points. So it does this weird hit point math where it affects this number of hit points, and then you start tallying up, this creature consumes this many of the hit point pool and whatever. And the creatures who are under effect are immediately completely unconscious and can only be woken up with, being slapped around or loud noises or et cetera. Right. No continued saves. It's not there.
Okay. So that's standard-ish.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny standard-ish. Because it surprises folks, especially design-minded folks, who got used to the fact that, in 5th edition, you always get another save. Well, turns out not for sleep.
Gotcha. Interesting. I think one of our close friends was in a convention 5th edition game or something like that, and his wizard took sleep, right, mm-hmm. knowing that we're accustomed to that being powerful. And then the DM actually pushed back against that and said, in my games, I don't like sleep. Why not? Because it's a spell that's very good at low level, and then the effect is basically negligible and worthless at high level. And our friend was like, well, that seems like good balancing there.
Right. I guess
why is that an argument against it?
Yeah. The other thing I forgot to mention, in 5th edition, sleep, as is traditional for sleep, no save. Ever.
What?
No save at all.
I forget that. No save. I always forget about that because, of course, in my games, everything negative has a save all the time.
Yep.
And I have actually started to forget about that. That is hideous.
Yep.
That wasn't in the edition.
Hmm?
Yeah. Weird. That wasn't the no save bit was not in the original book, but in the 1975 supplement is the first time it said that. There is no saving throw against this spell. It says that explicitly, but not until the supplement, which is way overpowered. But on the other hand, it affects so many people. Maybe they were thinking I don't want to roll so many saves.
don't know.
Every time I pick up this book, it puts a whole lot of extra light on my face. I'm like, wow, that's bright.
Nice, nice reflective book you've got there. All right, so, Dan, any final thoughts on mind control?
It's interesting that I guess the real problem is charm.
Yeah.
Like, I can deal with Gaius. I can deal with almost anything else.
You think deal because there's so much room for interpretation and it's a high level spell and you anticipate being requested to interpret.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. For me, I feel like that, at least for me in my games, that has worked. And then charm's the real weird thing, again, as evidenced by how much the writers radically changed that over the years. You know, compare that to sleep, right? So what you just looked at for sleep is very similar to what it was right out of the box in 1974.
Yep.
Affects a bunch of people, affects the low-powered ones first. There's a die roll. There's no save. That is, you know, you don't get extra saves per round. That is pretty darn close to what it was in 1974, but the charm spell has been radically changed. And it's weird that as you pointed out, by trying to alter the effect, it gets more and more nebulous and more hard to rule on, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, so I think that's where I stand is I think that magic should always be blatant. There's nothing sneaky about magic.
Yeah,
agreed. It should always be obvious. And if you just follow that guideline, you avoid a lot of weird gray areas in spells. Not just Charm Person, although Charm Person certainly stands out as a prime example of that.
Yeah, yeah. For the purpose of Charm Person, with that ruling, does that make that basically not useful in diplomatic settings? Does that basically make that only, opposition combat useful?
I think it's useful in diplomatic settings only when... the situation is exactly right? Like if we are solo with someone, and we have some opportunity to force them to do something, right? Like I charm the king in his bedroom and then I make him go out and make this proclamation, right?
Right.
Like,
Yep.
And then maybe even then I'm going to make a roll to be like, how much are people like, something's up with the king. It feels a little, did you notice a weird look in his eye? Like, what was going on there? That was strange.
I like that. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Feels right.
Yeah.
That's right. I think in my games, I actually have to sit down and come up with some, like, because people have pointed out this has come up at least three times this year alone of what happens if the charmer goes down. What happens if you're asked to attack your other allies? So I might actually have to... And your point about what happens if you have multiple mind controlling spells, that is not dealt with anywhere in the classic books. So I might have to sit down and actually write up some concrete protocols for when that comes up in the future. When the players use it on the monsters, it's never a problem. But when it gets used on the players, now it's a problem.
Why is that? Is it just because the monsters are so short lived? Inevitably, the thief's going to kill that charm victim.
Pretty much. And I'm not, and now I'm still playing, right, as DM, right? I still have stuff happening. I'm not morally offended. I'm still active in the game. But a player with one single character, if that character gets taken away from them, and then you can say, like, is that worse than just a death spell? Is that worse than being paralyzed or slept or just outright killed? And then you still have to... Like, for me, sometimes it's better for my character to just get killed because then I can start rolling up somebody else and get back in the game.
I mean,
but when your character is charmed, you're hanging in that respect.
Yeah. I would point out, like death, I think, is almost better than, like, petrification, right? Oh, they got petrified. Are we going to be able to find someone who's going to be able to restore them? Are we going to lug this statue around with us? Like, should I make a new character or not?
Yes, right. And, actually, as a little side point, nowadays I would tend to say yes, and maybe that character is temporary.
That's a good one.
I would tend to say yes, bring a character in, and if the other one gets resuscitated, now you've got two, or one's a hireling or graduated or whatever.
Oh, that's good. That's good. I like that.
But, yeah, I mean, that is the problem with the mind-controlling spells is what happens when the player agency is taken away and basically they don't get to make a decision on their turn. That's painful on both sides, frankly.
Great.
For the DM, I'm just bringing another 20 guys, and I'm like, great, I have enough decisions to make already. Take some away, please.
Yeah.
Take some away from me.
Awesome.
Take my NPCs, please.
All right, viewers, if you have stories of mind control gone awry, or I can think of some edge cases that we haven't thought of that need to be applied for, or know of certain items or effects that we missed that we should have gone over, please share your thoughts with us. Include them in the comments below. We'd love to hear what you think.
Absolutely. And remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter on Twitch by the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites.
And you can also get Wandering DMs audio versions of all of our shows at the top podcast providers and also on our website, wanderingdms.com.
That's right. And thank you to our patrons who support the show. And if you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Remember that we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Next week, we're planning a show on how to start as a new DM. So please join us next week for that topic and another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.